listening to Authentic Leadership for Everyday People, the podcast where we investigate the connection between effective leadership and authenticity. If you're looking for inspiration and tips on how to become a better leader by being your true self, you're in the right place. In the last episode, I talked about humor in the workplace and a framework to implement humor, use it effectively with your team. I really enjoy doing an episode where I am talking on a topic that I'm passionate about, so I decided to continue on the same path just for today. We'll have guests coming back in the next episodes. The topic that we're tackling today is serious. It's a topic of stress, resilience, and how they affect your leadership in the workplace. I'm going to share with you an overall framework on how to think about stress and what impacts our stress and things that we can do to mitigate it for both us and the organization. And I'm going to share my personal toolkit of tools that I use both for myself and with my client to improve the management of stress and to improve resiliency in my work. I hope you enjoyed this episode. We're going to just dive in right away. The idea for this episode came to me a couple of weeks ago, and it's inspired by a post that Erica Seidel put on LinkedIn. Erica is an executive recruiter who, with her own firm, The Connective Good, specializes in recruiting CMOs and marketing executives. She's a fabulous person. I was introduced to her a few years ago by a friend of mine. And I have been following her posts on her blog on the website. She had a wonderful podcast for a while, and I also follow her on LinkedIn because she's very thoughtful. She goes very deeply into the challenges that both marketing executives, CMOs who are looking for a job, and companies who are recruiting them face. So everything that she posts, I find very insightful, and I was really struck by this specific piece of content. She was talking about the current level of anxiety and emotion that senior executive in the marketing space are going through right now during their job search because it's a tough market in a lot of ways. She encouraged him by sharing 16 affirmations that she kept on her wall when she made the leap to start her own firm. Looking at those affirmations, it reminded me of some of the techniques that I use and some of the challenges that I navigate every day, like every entrepreneur, and how I use a lot of the thinking that is linked to her affirmations. As I was thinking about that, I realized that her post did not apply only to people that are out of work and looking for a job. I see it in the conversation with my clients. It's definitely a topic that comes into every session. It's a combination of the general pressure that we're always under in the business environment, and then the overall set of stressors that are present in the general world. The combination of having just come out recently from a traumatic event like the pandemic, the polarizing situation, not just in the US, but in every country, and then a really tense interracial environment with two major conflicts that both have the potential to create explosive conflict and deflagration across the whole world. All of these create a tremendous amount of pressure. We carry this into our day-to-day work. It made me realize that I want to talk about this topic. This show is called Authentic Leadership for Everyday People. I encourage all my coaching clients and all my listeners to be authentic, to be true to themselves. But one of the biggest causes of derailing from who we are, losing control, and making choices and taking decisions that are not in alignment with our own personality and our values is actually the pressure, the stress. Under stress, we are not ourselves. Our thinking gets unfocused, unclear, and we make decisions that ultimately sometimes we regret. My goal today is to provide you with an overall framework and then share some tactical ideas and some changes that you can make immediately to manage your stress. When you think about managing stress in your work environment, the intervention can be made across four very broad areas, and then there's an overarching theme that runs through them. Obviously, we will not cover all of these in a short episode. What I'm going to do is first, I'm going to briefly talk about the overarching theme and then three of the areas, and then we will dive a little deeper in the fourth area. The four areas are social and organizational support, organizational culture, work strategies and tactics, and then finally, last but definitely not least, and the one area that we will cover in depth, personal wellness and emotional balance. I also mentioned that there's one theme that runs across all of these broad areas. The theme is what I call continuous learning and development. In all these areas, you want to not only learn from your experience and the feedback that you get informally from the people around you, but actually you want to be deliberate and find opportunities for you to learn in a more formal ways, whether it is through reading of books and articles or actually maybe taking classes, finding an executive coach, etc., etc. So let's start with the first three areas. When I think about these three areas, they either relate to the external circumstances around you that impact your strengths, or there are actions that will impact those circumstances and then, as a consequence, reduce your stress. Social and organizational support. These are the people in your life that support you and that are there for you when you need them. So this includes your network outside of work, your personal network, your family, your friends, your professional network of informal friends, peers, mentors, and then also, just as importantly, your network inside your work and your organization. Who are your trusted peers? Who are the mentors? Who are the people that you can go to when you're going through a very difficult situation and you want to get that first advice or just encouragement? Second, organizational culture. How do you manage it to manage stress? Now, a couple of points before we get into that. From your personal point, first, looking at how organizational culture impacts your stress, you need to look very hard and figure out whether your corporate culture is positive or if it's toxic. Now, if you can have an impact on the culture, that's great, go at it. But there may be a point when you have to admit that it's not you, it's them, and you may need to make some decisions. This is an extreme situation. So let's look at a little more positive side of it. And that's my second point, which is that when we look at organizational culture and stress management, this includes your responsibilities toward your organization and the people who work with you. The more senior you are within your organization, the more people will take cue from your behavior. So remember that you need to lead by example. Now, here are a few other points that aim at what can you do as a leader to impact the culture and to create a culture that is positive and is less stressful. Well, first of all, a lot of stress comes from the fear of consequences and deadlines and expectations. So create a culture that encourages aiming high and doesn't punish people when unrealistic goals are met. There's a big difference between setting high expectations and ruling by fear. Second, create a culture where people are not punished when they make a mistake and they are transparent about the fact that they bring it up with a solution. So foster transparency in communication. Also, as a leader, encourage people to give you feedback and take action on the feedback when it's warranted. When you are giving critical feedback, do it in a constructive way and make sure that the feedback is focused on the action that needs to correct it and not the actual individual. Then be inclusive. And by that, I mean, make sure that everybody has a voice in the decision-making process. This doesn't mean making decisions by committee. Someone needs to make a decision and be accountable for it. It just means giving people an opportunity to share their point of view. And this also helps get them buy-in when you're making decisions that are unpopular if people had an opportunity to have their say. And then finally, set good boundaries between work and life for both yourself and your team and make sure that the boundaries are kept. If you're asking people to give up some of their personal time to work, make sure that it is for something that it's really worth it and that is an exception, not the rule. The third and final area I'm calling work strategies and tactics, and this relates to how you manage your overall work so that the stress is reduced by the fact that the work is done more effectively or as it is easier to execute. The first point is the prioritization strategies. You need to have a ruthless focus on what doesn't need to be done and ask yourself which activities create the most value and which ones are marginal. And don't be afraid to let go of the marginal ones. The second one is learn how to say no. Manage your own workload. When you're asked to add responsibilities or do something, ask yourself two questions. Is me taking this on mission critical? And will I help create significant value? And if the answer to that is yes, then there is an even more important question, which is, do I have the time to execute at the highest level? Or what's going to happen is that I'm going to take this on and then run the risk of not doing anything well because I'm spread too thin. Finally, another important point around strategies and tactics is optimizing your execution. Take a look at what you're doing, how you're doing it. Plan ahead, make sure that the right dependencies are respected and that you're allocating the right time for all the different tasks. And then finally, and this is more true as you become more of a leader, let go. Learn how to delegate effectively and trust that people are going to execute what you give them to do. social and organizational support, organizational culture, and work strategy and tactics are all areas that deal with external circumstances or our environment. We have some control on the environment, but we never have 100% control of the environment. However, we have 100% control on how we relate to that environment. And that is where the fourth area, personal wellness and emotional balance, comes into play. That's the area that I want to spend a little more time on and go a little more into depth, because that's what really resonated with me when I was relating my experience to the affirmations that Erica posted. There's another reason why I want to go a little deeper into this topic. I mentioned this in a couple of other episodes. About 25 years ago, I was in a challenging work circumstance and I let it get the best of me. I went through a pretty catastrophic episode of anxiety and depression. I had probably 2 or 3 months where I really couldn't function. And then it took me about 2 or 3 years to completely get out of it. It took a lot of work. Those years were certainly not fun. I'm proud that I was able to work through some very challenging phases, but I wouldn't wish it on anybody. There is a natural component to depression, and I certainly do have some mild tendencies, and that's something that I watch out for. But in that case, the diagnosis was clearly that depression was episodic, and that it was caused by my situation at the time, by the stress, the anxiety, and how I reacted to it. As I think about it, the professional circumstances that triggered that episode, while certainly challenging, were definitely not that catastrophic. It was just that I was very poorly equipped to deal with the situation. Over the past 25 years, through a combination of the therapy and the help that I got at the time, techniques that I picked up along the way, some that I made up myself, and then more formal education of the topic, I've put together an arsenal of tools that I can tap into when I am facing difficult work circumstances. There's certainly been a couple of situations in my career that were a lot more difficult than the ones that triggered the depression episode 25 years ago. And thanks to this toolkit that I put together for myself, I was able to navigate them pretty successfully. This section is called Personal Wellness and Emotional Balance. There's a number of practices that are really important, and I'm going to repeat them at the risk of stating the obvious. It's so obvious that it's actually easy to overlook it, and that is why I'm repeating it here. This is the first piece of advice and recommendation that any doctor will give us. There's a reason why it's the first piece of advice. It's because it is actually true. I'm talking about exercise, a healthy diet, good sleep, maintaining good routines around these. It's really important. As stress and anxiety mount, it is very easy to lose the discipline in keeping these routines. And so we enter into a vicious circle where we get stressed, we start sleeping on these routines. By sleeping on these routines, our stress level gets higher, and so forth. Keep an eye on maintaining those routines. I'm not talking about work-life balance here. I'm talking about making sure that you maintain the discipline to keep a base level of physical and mental health. You can think of these routines as the personal wellness component of the personal wellness and emotional balance area. So now let's get to the emotional balance part. And this is the toolkit that I mentioned earlier. This toolkit is my personal synthesis of a number of practices, books, and classes that I have taken. I want to mention the most important one, the ones from which really the richest elements are coming in. First of all, the book, The Relaxation Response by Herbert Benson. This is the beginning of the integration of meditation and mindfulness in Western medicine and practices. It's a book from 1975. Benson came up with the name of relaxation response as the opposite reaction to the fight or flight response. He also articulated steps that we can take to generate that response. Now, I want to make a small personal digression here. This book was given to me in 1997 by Hugh MacArthur, who right now is the chairman of the global private equity practice at Bain. Those were the early days of building that practice, and he was my manager. When I think about the corporate culture of that time, the tough it out mentality that dominated industries like investment banking, consulting, private equity, he was way ahead of his time on this topic. It was extraordinary that he gave the book to me, and I was very lucky. It was actually so extraordinary that I didn't get it at all when I read it. As a matter of fact, if I had understood it and started practicing it, I probably would have avoided my crisis, which came a couple of years later while I was at a different company. but you planted a seed, and it is only now clear to me the impact that that moment had on my life, and so I really want to thank him publicly. I say he planted a seed because I went back to the book a little over 15 years later, and this time I understood it. At that point, Benson's work had such an impact that in 2006, Mass General Hospital established the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine, and that's where I attended the SMART program. SMART is an acronym for Stress Management and Resilience Training, and that's an important source of the tools that I use. Since I started my coaching practice, it's been clear to me that these tools are key to be an effective coach. And so I was a pioneer member of the PQ Training Program for Coaching. That was the first time that the program was run. I want to give credit to Shehzad Shamin for brilliantly synthesizing an incredible amount of knowledge from various disciplines in an easily digestible format. If you're curious, I highly recommend his book, Positive Intelligence. Going through the program had a great impact on my life as well, and that's the third source of the toolkit that I'm going to share with you. Finally, there's a couple of other sources. I only took one point from each of these, but both of these play a huge part in my approach. One is the book It Takes What It Takes by Trevor Moad. The second one, as unlikely a source as this may be for stress management, is the negotiation class I took during the MBA program at Harvard, and the book that we use in the class, which is called Get Into Yes by Roger Fisher and William Ury. I want to give you a little caveat. You may actually get really intrigued by all the sources and go and do your own research, and then as you go through my toolkit, you may say, well, that's not exactly what the book said, or you have twisted this concept. And to that I answer yes, because what I'm trying to do is not to create research or to create theories. The way that I synthesize all these experiences and these sources is creating practices and tools that work for me. I have applied these concepts very successfully in the past 15 years to manage my anxiety, my stress, and navigate difficult situations. And I have used these concepts with my clients, and they have been able, by using these concepts and actually making their own version of them, to navigate their own circumstances. So my invite to you is, listen to what I have to say, take what works for you, and if something doesn't work for you, just ignore it. Now that we got all that out of the way, let me start with giving you a perspective on how I think stress and anxiety work for me, and I think they work for a lot of people for the same way. Ultimately, stress and anxiety are rooted in fear, specifically in fear of consequences. When I think about how to deal with them and when I think about how to tackle them, I think about three areas of intervention. The first area of intervention is separating fact from fiction. We are afraid that something's going to happen. And some of that may be true, some of that may not be true. So we need to go through a disciplined process of separating fact from fiction. The second area is looking at the narratives that are going inside our mind and thinking about the reactions that we have and thinking about our natural tendencies, and also recognize those when they're taking us down a path of believing more in the fiction than in the fact. And finally, and I really want to credit Shehzad for making a very explicit point about linking this to the first two areas that I did, is because of how our body is wired, there's only up a certain point in any situation where we're actually able to practice those two disciplines, when we're able to tackle the fact on the fiction, when you're able to recognize our reaction rising and stopping it. In order to be able to maintain that, we need to train our mind and our body to do it. And that's where the mindfulness practices come into play. Let's go a little deeper into each one of these three areas. And let's start with separating fact from fiction. There are really two activities that I want to focus on. The first one is assessing the facts and the likelihood of things to actually happen. And the second one is assessing the consequences. For the first one, I'm going to start with one of Erica's affirmations. And the affirmation goes like this: that thing that you're worrying about happening most likely will never happen. I call this O'Hara reframing, which is changing your perspective. I know that sometimes reframing is also used in a very technical way within the world of psychology, but here I'm just going to use it as a broader umbrella. When I think about reframing, I think about two things. Number one, we look at situations, we look at the risk involved, and we have an emotional reaction. we may feel that there's a really bad outcome coming, and that's the only thing that we keep in our mind. We don't go through the analytical process of looking at the possible outcomes, looking at the probability. Is that bad outcome really the only possible outcome if we don't get the good outcome? There may be a lot of other situations in between that are actually not as catastrophic. Or yes, that bad outcome is theoretically possible, but there's really no probability that it's going to happen. Or we don't have all the information that we need to actually figure out whether that's going to be a good or bad outcome. More often than not, the cause of that is the fact that we've gone from point A directly to point Z without taking a look at the steps in between. So a good exercise is to start from the catastrophic outcome and then go back step by step and see, okay, in order for this to happen, what needs to be true? Okay, in order for this point upstream to happen to be true, what needs to be true? And work all the way back to point A. And by the time we get to point A, we'll most likely find out that actually there's a whole series of steps in between that are almost impossible to happen. There are places where the likelihood of everything happening at the same time is almost impossible. And so the reality is that these outcomes that we're really worrying about is of very low likelihood. An important companion of assessing the probability of something happening is actually assessing then, once it happens, what are the consequences? Okay, so now we know that there's a high likelihood that things are going to go wrong, and we just leave with the fact that things are going to go wrong, and we let that drive our emotion and put us in a bad mental situation, and we don't think about the consequences. So this is where, you remember I mentioned something from the negotiation class. So there is a principle that was in the book, Get Into Yes, and it is now a pretty common principle applied in negotiation classes across the country. The principle is called BATNA. And BATNA is an acronym for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. Before every negotiation, one of the ways that you prepare yourself to understand where you can land in the negotiation is to assess, okay, if I'm not able to come to agreement on this contract, what is the best alternative that I have? So let me make a very simple example. I'm going to buy a car. I want to buy a luxury car, but I'm only willing to pay up to a certain price for that car. Now, what's going to happen if the dealer is not willing to meet my crazy price for that car, and then I ended up not buying the car? Well, I'm still going to be able to buy a different car. So the not getting of that car is not such a catastrophic event. I took this idea of seriously assessing what's going to happen if I cannot come to an agreement in a negotiation and turn it into what's going to happen if everything goes wrong. Let's take an example. You're a salesperson, you have to meet a certain quota, you're very stressed because it looks like you're not going to meet the quota, and you're getting so stressed that's actually getting in the way of you meeting your quota. But what's going to happen if you are not going to meet that quota? Well, maybe you're not going to make your bonus, but you're still going to make a salary. Or is there something worse that can happen? Well, if you don't get your quota to a certain point, you're going to be in the bottom percentage and you're going to be let go. Okay, can you live with being let go? And you may find out that you actually can live with being let go, because the reality is that you don't like that job that much. And if you liked it, you would have made your quota. And most importantly, as you go through this exercise of assessing what happens, you're going to get to a point where you realize that by the time you get to the consequence, that it's the one that's scaring you the most. The likelihood of getting you all the way to that consequence, it's pretty small. The moment that you got yourself comfortable living with the worst possible outcome is also the moment that you're starting managing your stress. And actually, you have a pretty strong position, because at this stage, you have nothing to worry about, because you know that you're going to be comfortable with that specific outcome. And that's the same way that when you walk into a negotiation and you know that you have a strong alternative to closing the negotiation, it allows you to walk away if your conditions aren't met. The second side of reframing is the way that we perceive interactions that we have with people around us, the assumptions that we make based on the interaction that we have with the people around us. One example that very often plays into work situations is we have a bad interaction either with our peer or somebody that we report to, and we assume that we're in trouble. We assume that there's something going on with us. And the reality is that this person may have a number of other things on their plate, and our portion of the work is only a small sliver of it. And that's maybe why they didn't give us the time of day. Or they may have had like a big worrisome situation somewhere else, a different priority, and so they're short with us. A good way to mitigate that when it happens is to once again ask yourself questions. Take a pause. What was the person's context? What else is going on in the other person's life? Is that interaction really aimed at me? By going through the exercise of answering these questions, most of the time you will find out that, yes, that wasn't a great interaction, but it doesn't mean that there's something deeper or nefarious going on with that person. You may think that the assumptions that we make about our interactions with others are part of the second point, our internal narratives, and you may not necessarily be wrong, but I am defining the term and using it in a way that is a little different. The way that I think about internal narrative in this context is not how we react to external narratives, but it's a set of assumptions that we have about ourselves, that we hold about ourselves, and the self-judging that goes on. Going back to Erica, there's a couple of great quotes that she had that refer to this area. One is, your need to be perfect is so boring. And the other one is, comparing yourself to other success only slows you down from finding your own. Sometimes we're so busy thinking about ourselves, thinking about our narratives, that is what causes the stress. This idea of the internal narrative has been given many voices and many names. A name that is pretty common in coaching and that is actually at the core of Shirzad's positive intelligence system is the idea of a saboteur. So an internal voice that speaks to us and slows us down and sabotages. Some of the names that he gives to the saboteurs reflect some of the activities that we're doing when we're sabotaging yourself. You know, judging ourselves, I've talked about it. Perfectionism, the need to control, walking into a situation feeling like a victim, judging yourself solely on the level of success that you're achieving, and then failing to see that maybe you've reached already a very high level of success and you're not enjoying it because you're looking at the other success ahead. Now, I want to say something very important that's also going to overlap with our next point. When I talk about judging yourself of a level of success and being content with where you are, I'm not talking about dropping ambition. I'm talking about being in a situation where you can, at the same time, appreciate what you have achieved and see ahead what you still need to do to close the gap. And most importantly, not be in a situation where your obsession with the fact that you have not yet achieved the level of success that you want is becoming a hindrance to your actual ability to have the success. When I'm talking about managing our internal narratives, this is what I'm talking about. Recognizing those voices inside ourselves that are telling us all these things about ourselves and stopping the behaviors that are caused by those voices. Those two areas of intervention that we just discussed, separating fact from fiction and managing our internal narratives, require an intervention. That intervention isn't easy. We need to recognize the situation that we're in. We need to recognize what we're doing, how we're reacting, and then we need to ask ourselves the right questions to get the right answers that are going to help us de-escalate the situation. A great concept, and probably the most important concept that I took from the PQ training program, is the idea that we can actually train our mind and our body to be able to react and take action when we find ourselves in a challenging situation. Let's start with training our mind. It starts with all the ideas that I just mentioned, the idea of separating fact from fiction and identifying places where you could do that and maybe do little exercises around that with smaller situation right now. And then recognizing which are the types of internal narratives that we have. Are you somebody who tends to be a perfectionist? Are you somebody who tends to be a control freak? Which of those voices take over? And what happens when you get into that persona? The process of consistently being able to recognize these patterns, to recognize these opportunities, is the first step to being able to deal with them when we're faced with them in a stressful situation. Another part in training your mind is which side of the situation do we look at? Do we look first at all the things that can go wrong, or do we look first at all the things that are positive? Make a practice of this. Be intentional. Every time you look at something, force yourself to first looking at the things that are positive and list them out, and then look at the things that are negatives and that need to be fixed. But by training yourself to always looking at the positive first, once again, when you all find yourself in a difficult situation, you will not have this instinct to go instantly towards the bad side of it. If you're like me, though, when somebody tells you about positivity, sometimes you may have the reaction that, you know, there are situations where you cannot be positive. There are situations where positivity is toxic. And I agree with you 100%, which is why a concept that greatly resonated with me is the idea of neutrality. This is the concept that I got from Trevor Moad. I mentioned his book earlier on. Trevor Moad was a sports performance coach. He was very well known. He worked with some truly elite athletes. He was the performance coach for Alabama when they won several national championships. And probably the person that he's most closely associated with is Russell Wilson. Trevor was his sports performance coach during his run when he won the Super Bowl. And one of the things that Trevor talks about in his book is that the impact that we can create for ourselves just by removing the negative is already incredibly high. The great metaphor that he uses is that when we're driving our car, we don't shift directly from reverse into drive when we're moving. We actually stop and then shift. This is the same concept. If we can stop our negative thinking, that stop alone will greatly enhance our performance. Practicing eliminating negative thoughts and negative feelings is actually a lot easier than going directly into positive. I talked about the idea of training the mind and the body. I'm not going to go into the science as to how the body works in the neuroscience. There are plenty of explanations in the books that I mentioned. Within Sirzad's book, there's actually all the sources to all the deeper science that he took to do this. What I'm going to share with you is that when I tried these practices, and there are million and million of other people who are trying these practices, they actually work. The first one is meditation. When I say the word meditation, some of you may think about a long, extended hours and hours process, and maybe sometimes even tied to spiritual or religious practice. And there are certainly versions of that. This is not what we're talking about. The Benson book, The Relaxation Response, explains the technique to elicit the relaxation response through meditation. And it's a simple 15 minutes process, 10 to 15 minutes process, being in a quiet room, keeping a passive and quiet mind, and then just simply choosing one phrase or one word that you repeat and paying attention to your breathing. Since I started doing this about 10 years ago, I've had incredible physical and mental benefits from it. The second is mindfulness. And mindfulness, just to make a really quick summary, is the idea of being really present and paying attention to whatever it is that you're doing. There's a subset of mindfulness. And that's actually also what Sirzad uses in his PQ training. And that is the idea to focus on a single sense, whether it is your sense of touch, your sense of hearing, your sight, for bursts of 10 to 15 seconds. If you start building a practice of doing that several times a day, over time you will get to a point where just a single touch of that will really help you. For instance, a practice that I have incorporated is often before a meeting, I will just take a few seconds and touch the tip of my thumb to the tip of my index finger and just for 10 seconds focus on that. And that really grounds me as I am about to speak. Another version of the sense-based mindfulness is the breathing. You try to empty your mind and you just focus on the feeling and the temperature of the air coming through your nose, feeling the air coming into your lungs and your belly and then the air going out. That also really helps. As I get to the end of this episode, I realized that I really got carried away. I packed a lot more information than I was planning in the beginning. I want to close with the affirmation by Erica from her post that really resonated with me and ultimately inspired me to do this episode. The affirmation says, "New activity cures anxiety. Action of any type is a balm on fear." The magic word here is that little action of any type, a technique that I've used multiple times. If I am faced with an overwhelming activity or a task that looks impossible or that looks like the outcome will be so far in the distance that just keeping going for the whole time necessary to achieve it is not just overwhelming, but actually paralyzing. One way to step into action and get over the paralysis is to find a little task that doesn't necessarily need to get us to where we want to get, but creates the impression and the feeling that we're making progress. And just simply by having that feeling on that little smaller action, I break the impasse and then I start tackling on the larger actions that ultimately create the success and really completely eliminate the anxiety. Okay, I lied because I'm going to tell you one more truly final thing. Remember, if things get overwhelming, as you start feeling a little bit of stress, never ever be afraid to ask for help. That is the most important thing. And you will find, as you ask for help to the people around you, that a lot more people are willing to help than you think. And with that, I will leave you to the closing credits. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, find a friend who may like it and tell them that they should listen to it. You may have listened to every single episode so far, in which case I'm really grateful, but most likely you haven't. So go back, find a few others and listen to them. There's a lot of good choice in my feed. As usual, if you like the show, tell all your friends and post about it on social media. Every little bit helps. Make sure you subscribe to the show on your favorite listening platform so you don't miss any episode. And if you listen on a platform that allows ratings and reviews like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, Good Pods, please leave us a stellar rating and write a review. Give us 5 stars. Stay tuned because after the credits, I will play a song by Susan Catania, one of Boston's best Americana singer-songwriters. For more information on the episode and all the links, go to the website al4ep.com, spelled with the number 4. You can email me at dino@al4ep.com. And make sure you follow the podcast on whatever social platform you're on. On Twitter and Instagram, the handle is @al4edp with the letter D. And on Facebook, you can look for Authentic Leadership for Everyday People. This episode was written and produced by me, Dino Cattaneo, recorded entirely within the script using their Squadcast recording software. The theme music was composed, produced, and arranged by Nicholas Cattaneo, who also played keyboards and drums, with Tony Savarino on guitar and Jesse Williams on bass. And now here's a song by Susan Cattaneo. It's from her album, The Hammer and the Heart. It's a duet with Boston great Dennis Brennan, and it's called Dry.
Shut my eyes. You don't wanna talk, and I don't wanna fight. I shut my eyes.
We fake a smile, so polite. Put on a show, but nothing makes us right. We fake a smile, come apart
We came as lovers. That's who we were, not who we are. We've come apart.
Come apart.
This well's gone dry.